Dawn of Flame by Stanley G. Weinbaum. Chapter 5. Black Margot. Hall circled wide through the forest, and it took all his mountain craft to slip free through the files of woods runners. He came at last to the fields east of Ormiston, and there made the road, entering from the direction of Siluie. Everywhere were evidences of rout. Wagons lay overturned, their teams doubtless used to further the escape of their drivers. Guns and rifles, many of them burst, littered the roadside, and now and again he passed black smoking piles and charred areas that marked the resting place of an ammunition cart. Yet Ormiston was little damaged. He saw the fire-gutted remains of a shed or two where powder had been stored, and down the street a house roof still smoked. But there was no sign of battle carnage, and only the crowded street gave evidence of the unusual. He found File Ormiston in the group that stared across town, to where the road from Norse elbowed east to enter. Hall had outsped the leisurely march of the master, for there at the bend was the glittering army, now halted. Not even the woods runners had come into Ormiston town, for there they were too, lined in a brown-clad rank along the edge of the woodlots beyond the nearer fields. They had made no effort, apparently, to take prisoners, but had simply herded the terrified defenders into the village. Joaquin Smith had done it again. He had taken a town without a single death, or at least no casualties other than whatever injuries had come from bursting rifles and blazing powder. Suddenly, Hall noticed something. "Where are the Confederation men?" he asked sharply. File Ormiston turned gloomy eyes on him. "Gone. Flying back to Siluie like scared gophers to their holes." He scowled, then smiled. "That was a fool's gesture of yours at Eagle Foot Flow, Hall. A fool's gesture. But brave." The youth grimaced wryly. "I thought I was followed." "And so you should have been, but that those fiendish ticklers tickled away our courage. But they can kill as well as tickle. When there was need of it before Memphis, they killed quickly enough." Hall thought of the green-eyed youth. "I think I nearly learned that," he said, smiling. Down the way, there was some sort of stir. Hall narrowed his eyes to watch, and descried the silver helmet of the master. He dismounted and faced someone. It was, yes, old Marcus Ormiston. He left File Ormiston, and shouldered his way to the edge of the crowd that circled the two. Joaquin Smith was speaking. "And," he said, "all taxes are to be forwarded to New Orleans, including those on your own lands. Half of them I shall use to maintain my government, but half will revert to your own district, which will be under a governor I shall appoint in Siluie when that city is taken. You are no longer Eldark, but for the present you may collect the taxes at the rate I prescribe." Old Marcus was bitterly afraid. Hall could see his beard waggling like an oriole's nest in a breeze. Yet there was a shrewd bargaining streak in him. "You are very hard," he whined. "You left Pace Helm as Eldark undisturbed in Norse. Why do you punish me because I fought to hold what was mine? Why should that anger you so?"
"I am not angry," said the master passively. "I never blame any for fighting against me, but it is my policy to favor those Eldarks who yield peacefully." He paused. "Those are my terms, and generous enough."
They were generous, thought Hall, especially to the people of Ormiston, who received back much less than half their taxes from the Eldark, as roads, bridges, or wells.
My lands?" faltered the old man.
"Keep what you till," said Joaquin Smith indifferently. "The rest of them go to their tenants."
He turned away, placed foot to stirrup, and swung upon his great white mare. Hall caught his first fair glimpse of the conqueror. Black hair cropped below his ears, cool greenish-gray eyes, a mouth with something faintly humorous about it. He was tall as Hall himself, more slender,
but with powerful shoulders, and he seemed no older than the late 20s, or no more than 30 at most, though that was only the magic of Martin Serre, since more than 80 years had passed since his birth in the mountains of Mexico. He wore the warrior's garb of the Southlands, a shirt of metallic silver scales, short thigh-length trousers of some shiny silken material, cothurns on his feet. His bronze body was like the ancient statues Hall had seen in Salui, and he hardly looked the fiend that most people thought him. A pleasant-seeming man, save for something faintly arrogant in his face. No, not arrogant exactly, but proud or confident, as if he felt himself a being driven by fate, as perhaps he was. He spoke again, now to his men. "Camp there," he ordered, waving at Ormiston Square. "And there," pointing at a fallow field. "Do not damage the crops." He rode forward, and a dozen officers followed. "The church," he said. A voice, a tense, shrieking voice, behind Hall.
"You! It is Hall! It's you!"
It was Vale, teary-eyed and pale.
"They said you were..."
She broke off sobbing, clinging to him, while Enoch Ormiston watched sourly. He held her.
"It seems I failed you," he said ruefully. "But I did do my best, Vale."
"Failed? I don't care," she calmed. "I don't care, Hall, since you're here."
"And it isn't as bad as it might be," he consoled. "He wasn't as severe as I feared."
"Severe?" she echoed. "Do you believe those mild words of hers, Hall? First our taxes, then our lands, and next it will be our lives, or at least my father's life. Don't you understand? That was no Eldark from some enemy town, Hall. That was Joaquin Smith. Joaquin Smith, do you trust him?"
"Vale, do you believe that?"
"Of course I believe it." She began to sob again. "See how he's already won over half the town with that about the taxes. Don't you be won over, Hall. I couldn't stand it."
"I will not," he promised.
"He and Black Margot and their craft. I hate them, Hall. Look there. Look there."
He spun around. For a moment he saw nothing save the green-eyed youth who had turned death-laden eyes at him at Eaglefoot Flow, mounted on the mighty black stallion.
Youth? He saw suddenly that it was a woman. A girl, rather. 18? 25? He couldn't tell.
Her face was averted as she scanned the crowd that lined the opposite side of the street, but the sunset fell on a flaming black mop of hair, so black that it glinted blue. An intense, unbelievable black. Like Joaquin Smith, she wore only a shirt and very abbreviated shorts, but a caparison protected the slim daintiness of her legs from any contact with the mount's ribs. There was a curious grace in the way she sat the idling steed, one hand on its haunches, the other on Withers, the bridle dangling loose. Her Spanish mother's blood shone only in the clear, transparent olive of her skin, and, of course, in the startling ebony of her hair.
"Black Margot," Hall whispered. "Brazen, half naked. What's so beautiful about her?"
As if she heard his whisper, she turned suddenly, her emerald eyes sweeping the crowd about him, and he felt his question answered. Her beauty was starkly incredible, audacious, outrageous. It was more than a mere lack of flaws. It was a sultry, flaming, positive beauty, with a hint of sullenness in it. The humor of the master's mouth lurked about hers as mockery. Her perfect lips seemed always about to smile, but to smile cruelly and sardonically. Hers was a ruthless and pitiless perfection, but it was nevertheless perfection, even to the faintly oriental cast given by her black hair and sea-green eyes. Those eyes met Hall's, and it was almost as if he heard an audible click. He saw recognition in her face, and she passed her glance casually over his mighty figure. He stiffened, stared defiantly back, and swept his own gaze insolently over her body, from the midnight hair to the diminutive cothurns on her feet. If she acknowledged his gaze at all, it was by the faintest of all possible smiles of mockery, as she rode coolly away towards Joaquin Smith. Vale was trembling against him, and it was a great relief to look into her deep but not at all mysterious blue eyes, and to see the quite understandable loveliness of her pale features. What if she hadn't the insolent brilliance of the princess? He thought fiercely. She was sweet and honest and loyal to her beliefs, and he loved her. Yet he could not keep his eyes from straying once more to the figure on the black stallion.
She smiled at you, Hall, gasped Vale. I'm frightened. I'm terribly frightened.
His fascination was yielding now to a surge of hatred for Joaquin Smith, for the princess, for the whole empire. It was Vale he loved, and she was being crushed by these. An idea formed slowly as he stared down the street to where Joaquin Smith had dismounted and was now striding into the little church. He heard an approving murmur sweep the crowd, already half won over by the distribution of land. That was simply policy. The master's worshipping in Ormiston Church. A gesture to the crowd. He lifted the steel bow from his back and bent it. The spring was still in it. It had been heated enough to scorch his skin, but not enough to untemper it. Wait here, he snapped to Vale, and strode up the street toward the church. Outside stood a dozen empire men, and the princess idled on her great black horse. He slipped across the churchyard, around behind where a tangle of vines stretched toward the roof. Would they support his weight? They did, and he pulled himself hand over hand to the eaves, and thence to the peak. The spire hid him from the master's men, and not one of the Ormiston folk glanced his way. He crept forward to the base of the steeple. Now he must leave the peak and creep precariously along the steep slope around it. He reached the street edge and peered cautiously over. The master was still within. Against his will, he glanced at Black Margot, and even put cord to feather and sighted at her ivory throat. But he could not. He could not loose the shaft. Below him, there was a stir. Joaquin Smith came out and swung to his white horse. Now was the moment. Hall rose to his knees, hoping that he could remain steady on the sharp pitch of the roof. Carefully, carefully, he drew the steel arrow back. There was a shout. He had been seen, and a blue beam sent racking pain through his body. For an instant, he bore it, then loosed his arrow, and went sliding down the roof edge and over. He fell on soft loam. A dozen hands seized him, dragged him upright, thrust him out into the street. He saw Joaquin Smith still on his horse, but the glistening arrow stood upright like a plume in his silver helmet, and a trickle of blood was red on his cheek. But he wasn't killed. He raised the helmet from his head, waved aside the cluster of officers, and with his own hands bound a white cloth about his forehead. Then he turned cool gray eyes on Hall. "You drive a strong shaft," he said. And then recognition flickered in his eyes. "I spared your life some hours ago, did I not?" Hall said nothing. "Why," resumed the master, "do you seek to kill me after your Eldark has made peace with me? You are part of the Empire now, and this is treason." "I made no peace," growled Hall. "But your leader did, thereby binding you." Hall could not keep his gaze from the emerald eyes of the princess, who was watching him without expression, save faint mockery.
"Have you nothing to say?" asked Joaquin Smith. "Nothing."
The master's eyes slid over him.
"Are you Ormiston-born?" he asked. "What is your name?"
No need to bring troubles on his friends.
"No," said Hall. "I am called Hall Tarvish."
The conqueror turned away.
"Lock him up," he ordered coolly. Let him make whatever preparations his religion requires, and then execute him.
Above the murmur of the crowd, Hall heard Vale Ormiston's cry of anguish. He turned to smile at her, watched her held by two Empire men as she struggled to reach him.
"I'm sorry," he called gently. "I love you, Vale."
Then he was being thrust away down the street. He was pushed into Hugh Helm's stone-walled tool shed. It had been cleared of everything, doubtless for some officer's quarters. Hall drew himself up and stood passively in the gathering darkness, where a single shaft of sunset light angled through the door, before which stood two grim Empire men. One of them spoke.
"Keep peaceful, Weed," he said in his Norland drawl. "Go ahead with your praying, or whatever it is you do." "I do nothing," said Hall. "The Mountaineers believe that a right life is better than a right ending, and right or wrong, a ghost's but a ghost anyway."
The guard laughed.
"And a ghost you'll be." "If a ghost I'll be," retorted Hall, turning slowly toward him, "I'd sooner turn one fighting."
He sprang suddenly, crashed a mighty fist against the arm that bore the weapon, thrust one guard upon the other, and overleaped the tangle into the dusk. As he spun the circle of the house, something very hard smashed viciously against the back of his skull, sending him sprawling, half-dazed, against the wall. Footnote 4. Weed. The term applied by Dominists, the master's partisans, to their opposers. It originated in Joaquin Smith's remark before the Battle of Memphis.
"Even the weeds of the field have taken arms against me."
End of chapter 5.